On today's episode of Hey, We Need to Talk.
You know, and there's this myth that therapy, like you said, though, is for people with just like trauma-inducing problems. But it's those things, but so much more. Therapy is always a good option for everybody to consider.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3. Today's topic is using technology to normalize therapy. Well, we have Micheline Khan, and she's the founder and CEO of Althea, a digital resource for BIPOC, so that they could find resources for mental health professionals and mental wellness professionals. So we're just going to give Micheline an opportunity to introduce herself. Tell us a bit about her brand, give us a little bit of her background, the inspiration for Althea, her social media handles so that you guys can find her, and just a little bit of information in case you need to reach out to her for collaboration and additional resources. So take it away.
Thank you. Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm the founder and CEO of Althea. It's an app that makes it easy to find Black, Indigenous, and people of color mental health and wellness professionals. It's only in Canada at the moment. I'm Canadian. But it's also a resource hub for anyone seeking information or resources on mental health support, particularly for racialized and vulnerable groups, but also for anybody looking for just support. And, you know, I wanted to build this app to be a different way to engage with therapy. And, you know, I think especially for people of color, we have so many barriers to accessing mental health support. And when 2020 happened, it really was just the impetus for me to take that next step. You know, my app was, I'm actually an ecologist by trade. I work in climate and biodiversity. And last year, you know, I was really pushed to try and find something to build for my community. Everything that was going on with all the anti-Black racism and even, you know, racism against the Asian American mm-hmm. community and globally. And I was raised by two absolutely incredible parents. We're watching them as I grew up, you know, really shape the way that I view community and service. Building this was just, it felt like a natural next step for me. So I moved into the tech space, learned how to build it, and released it this year. I think it's just a really important resource for communities of color.
All right. And the website is www.althetherapy.com. Althetherapy.com. And I think that's amazing because this is a resource that I've been hunting for and looking for. I know that you say it's only available in Canada right now, but I've always wondered where people of color could find mental health resources. It seems as if it was something that was targeted to, you know, white people and, you know, the everyday stay-at-home mom. And it was just like this fad. And I as I went through my own mental health journey, I realized, no, this discussion is for everybody and these resources should be accessible to everybody, but they aren't always, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm just so grateful that this is the first step in the right direction. I could see Althea growing and becoming a global community, and I just can't wait for the people to get connected to you so that it could expand
and
could reach more people of color. So getting right into the discussion topics, you're welcome. We're going to talk about dismantling cliches about therapy. Who is therapy for? Why does therapy get a bad rap? And we're also going to talk about, you know, people of color and their relationship to mental health, because I have had so many conversations with friends and they seem to think that therapy is for crazy people. They think it's for weak people. They think it's for people who can't get it together. And I think everybody goes through periods of anxiety, goes through periods of depression for various reasons. So I just think we should start off by dismantling those cliches and, you know, get right into that. Who is therapy for?
No, that's a great way to start. And it just always reminds me, because when I was younger, I distinctly remember thinking therapy is good, but it's not for me. You know, it's for people with real problems. And then when I had real problems, I still thought, well, I'm strong. I can get through it on my own. I'll pray about it. And it wasn't until I went to my first therapy session with someone as support that I realized how valuable it was, how much I learned about myself and the choices that I make from sitting in on a session that wasn't even for me. You know, and there's this myth that therapy, like you said, though, is for people with just like trauma-inducing problems or people with illnesses. But it's those things, but so much more. It's just really a space for everybody, like you said. It's, you may have, you know, other options or ways that you want to deal with your setbacks and your traumas or, you know, addressing negative thought patterns. And that's fine. But therapy is always a good option for everybody to consider. So I feel like that's probably the best way to kind of say who therapy is for.
Why do you think that Black people have a negative relationship when it comes to therapy? Why do you think it's something that we tend to shy away from? Because I'm going to speak specifically for my community, you know, as a Black woman in living in the Caribbean, mental health is a topic that we're just now getting into. And it's beautiful, but at the same time, you know, there's so much more progress that can be made. For a while, there have been spaces where non-Black people or I should say white people have been more vocal about it. Why do you think that we are so hesitant to discuss our mental health issues?
I mean, it's a loaded question, and I think it's also, it's not, there's not one answer. Because I think within our communities, there's so much. There's even just that, what do we call it, the strong Black woman trope.
Yes.
That it impacts every Black community. You know, we feel like we must live up to this ideal that is not sustainable. You know, when in reality, you know, going to therapy is one of the most courageous things you can do for yourself or your family. And I think when we talk about communities of color, we have to consider the why these stigmas exist in place. And I think there's so much general distrust in this system.
Yes.
Because we already know there's like profound inequities in BIPOC communities using mental health services. You know, there's systemic inequities, there's implicit bias by white clinicians, so you already don't feel like you're in a safe space.
Yes, in the medical system overall.
Exactly. You know, we could talk about Black Maternal Health Week, you know, all of that stuff, but I think what it really comes down to is there's a history of oppression in mental health. So there's an overrepresentation of Black and brown people admitted to psychiatric units. I think they're 4 times more likely to be admitted than white patients. BIPOC clients are also more likely to be given medication rather than being offered counseling or psychotherapy. So there's a history that we need to address there. And that's likely why there's so much taboo and so much stigma associated with it. There are negative historical reasons. You know, these communities don't like it. I think also because it's a space really dominated by white clinicians for the most part. So you don't see yourself represented in it. So I think trust is a big thing. And we see this mirrored in, you know, in healthcare, like you mentioned, we see this all the time, particularly Black people, Black women are, you know, mistreated in the healthcare system where our symptoms are ignored and it ends up leading to worse symptoms or death. So this translates to mental health. You know, it's also one of the reasons why I built Althea, because building trust with your therapist is so that you can be vulnerable there in a safe space. And if I have, there's so much research that suggests that having a clinician who matches or identifies with unique cultural identity, you will have patient outcomes. Exactly. So if I know I have a therapist who identifies with my cultural identity, and I know I'm going to have better patient outcomes, that's what I'm going to go for.
Yeah, definitely. And I like the fact that you brought that up, because we connected because of the article I wrote on Medium, you know, why Black women deserve therapists who look like them. And I spoke about how having a white therapist significantly, it was a completely different experience from having a Black therapist, or the Black therapist, she was able to understand, you know, certain things about me. I didn't have to spend half of the session explaining Ebonics and, you know, explaining certain cultural events that was taking place, whereas with the white therapist, she seemed a little bit, you know, not in touch. And it definitely mattered. It made me feel more comfortable when it came to speaking with my Black therapist. It prevented a lot of waste of time, so we could just get straight into the issues. And it definitely matters. And I think that's why Althea matters, because it took me so long to find my Black therapist. It took me so long to find a Black therapist who I could connect with, because it's not just someone who looks like you, it's also someone who could understand you, understand where you came from, your history, your story, and is willing to learn. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about technology as a tool and resource for therapy, and how resources like Althea, databases such as that, could increase the visibility of providers of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what you said is so important, because your story is, you know, is mirrored across so many different people. We all go through something similar when you're looking for therapists. So I think, firstly, when we're thinking about technology for therapy, this, and thinking of an app that does something like this, firstly, you're cutting out all of that wasted time where mm-hmm. you're searching constantly. If anybody has, you know, looked for a therapist, it sometimes takes like a lot of time.
It took me years.
Yeah, and exactly, mm-hmm. years to find somebody that you want to stick with. And sometimes it's finding a Black therapist, and then layered on top of finding one that maybe uses your insurance, all mm-hmm. these different things. And for other cultures, it's language, it's price, it's so many things that they need to take into account, religion mm-hmm. also. So you want to have a place where you can search for all of these things in one space, where you're mm-hmm. increasing this visibility. Because number one, we always know of, when we think of therapy, we think of white people. We mm-hmm. think that this is a space for white people. We think it's only white people who are doing mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
And you're also, you want to break that, you know, that barrier and address that gap. So by having a space curated just for therapists of color, it's super important, because number one, we're also bringing business to them.
Yes.
We want to do that. We want to mm-hmm. bring business to our communities. And we want to be in a space where they want to serve their own communities. We want to be able to find therapists who are going to be, who can help with that. And I think this is one of the benefits of using technology to do that. Also, like with my app, there's also different things, different forms of engagement on it, because you want people to get comfortable talking about mental health and talking about therapy, and ways for people to help each other in sort of a peer support way. So I think in that sense, this is the side of technology that can be really useful in normalizing therapy.
Speaking of sides, you know, technology could be a useful tool, but it could also be a detrimental tool. When we talk about technology, we think about social media, and we think about Instagram, and how Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, even YouTube, they sometimes present images and ideologies which could affect our self-esteem, could cause us to become more anxious and feel like, you know, we're not keeping up, think that, you know, we're missing out on life, cause us to compare our lives to someone else who is really just fabricating this life for viewership, for likes, for feedback. Yeah. You know, just so that they could have a certain amount of engagement, so that brands would reach out to them for deals. And it's interesting, because I think to an extent, a therapy has become like this trend. Like when I look on TikTok, I see people like, you know, just making those 30-second reels, and, you know, they're kind of talking about it, and it's sort of cute. But I know that there's some people who genuinely care about the topic of therapy, but then there are others who are like monetizing people's insecurities. You know, mm-hmm. people who are like riding a wave. So I just wanted your opinion on how the viewing audience could learn how to spot over-commodified versions of therapy, and how they could also spot people who might be engaging in performative activism. Because we saw that a lot, especially with last year, when there were a lot of businesses trying to ride the wave of George Floyd's death, and you know, all the other Black persons who experienced police brutality. There are a lot of businesses, you know, who simply posted up the Black square and that was it. And we were afraid that, you know, they were just doing this for engagement, not to lose their following. And then there were other businesses who were more proactive. And how could we, as persons who are seeking to improve our mental health, find better opportunities for therapy, and persons with platforms such as yours, not just out there, but maybe a social media platform, myself as a blogger and writer on Medium, how can we spot those persons who are given genuine information, well-researched information, and access to other resources versus those persons who are just riding the wave?
Mm-hmm. That's a really important question. And I think sometimes it can be difficult because of the way that, you know, information passes on technology. People mm-hmm. scroll through feeds so quickly, mm-hmm. liking things, sharing them so quickly without vetting and checking, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is difficult. And even when you're sharing things like that and you haven't really checked if that's accurate, it still mm-hmm. is a form of performative allyship, yeah. you know, it's your,
yeah.
and so you really do need to be careful there. But I think, you know, one of the ways that I've noticed this is people who put action first mm-hmm. when we're talking about these types of things, people who are literally sharing donation links, giving you a list of things that you can do and that they have also done to support. For instance, when we're talking about George Floyd and anti-Black racism, brutality, those things, it is also, if it's a white activist or a white influencer, it is them muting themselves and giving their platform to a Black person to speak mm-hmm. on this issue because they are not equipped to talk about this and they mm-hmm. should not be. You know, so it's like you really need to see them not centering them in the discussion.
And then
focusing on the people whose voices matter, whose voices are the ones being oppressed, and that they need this platform. And I think, and then just looking for people who are really showing you what actions and what steps they've actually taken to dismantle certain systems, right? And I think when you talk though about therapy and over-commodified versions of therapy, it's funny because the first thing that actually comes to mind is, you know, how we've commercialized self-care.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that I was thinking. I was like, oh, it's this, you know. But because you see it all the time. Self-care, I feel like, originally started out as a way to, you know, put yourselves first and to yeah. make sure we're taking care of ourselves, ultimately take care of others, to check in with ourselves, mm-hmm. to support our own healing. And now it's become a very expensive, almost exclusive yes. in a sense, this measure of your success, particularly mm-hmm. for women.
Yeah.
You know, if we're unhappy or we're going through something, we use self-care, buy all of these massages or scented candles or things. And I love all yes. those things, don't get me wrong. But
it's so much more than that.
Yeah, exactly. You'll just end up in a cycle. You keep buying to try and keep making yourself feel better. And I yeah. think what real self-care is building a habit and a mm-hmm. practice of introspection, of kindness yeah. to yourself and others, of digging deep to understand what you really need.
It's difficult.
And then doing that every day. Yeah, it's hard. And some days self-care is not a happy thing. And I think that's also the delusion, is that it's always something that brings you happiness right away. And that's not what it is.
Yeah.
It's a long time. Yeah.
I
don't know. I think I kind of took your question.
No. That was perfect. That actually segues into the, you know, the next thing that we're going to talk about in terms of, you know, instant versus delayed gratification in a digital age. But just to harken back to what you're talking about, I remember that I started out my self-care journey buying candles. And, you know, that was great. Awesome. You know, I love candles. And it really
I actually love them.
Yeah, exactly. They helped me to relax. But then I realized that I needed to up my game and journal and actually get a therapist. And, you know, when me and my therapist finally hit some hardcore questions and I found myself crying at several therapy sessions and realizing that I had to do some internal work to make some changes, I realized what real self-care looked like. It means digging deep, being vulnerable, making changes, and breaking habits that you have spent years solidifying. And not everyone is ready to have that conversation. It's just become this thing where, you know, it's packaged in a cute little bow and presented on social media, and you see people taking bubble baths and, you know, doing all this stuff. But it's that self-care as well, but let's talk about therapy, let's talk about wellness professionals, you know, those persons who have gone to school and gotten degrees and are presenting themselves and say, hey, I am ready and willing and able to help you to do the hard work so that we could break certain stigmas inside our communities, so that we could build generational wealth, so we could talk to our parents about, you know, things that happened in our childhood and break certain, you know, generational curses or cycles or things that just, once we address them, would help our communities, our Black communities and our global community to flourish. So, I wanted to talk about the pros and cons of living in a digital age and its effect on mental health, because, you know, this is the age of free education and also misinformation, and it could just be really difficult to set healthy boundaries when it comes to social media. One of the ways that I do it is just deleting Instagram for a week. And, you know, as young people, so much of our lives, especially during quarantine, is taking place online. Like, we need our phones in our hands all the time. We need to be in front of a screen. So let us know, how do you practice setting healthy boundaries when it comes to social media?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is important, I think, especially with this younger generation, Gen mm-hmm. Z. I know they're going to come out fine, but I worry a little bit, because they really entered their childhood, their teenage years with technology.
Yeah.
So that is kind of the basis for their engagement and communication mm-hmm. with other people and different things like that. So at least with my generation, I know the before. So I think it's a little bit easier, I think, for me. But yeah, I think I do a lot of the things that people probably talk about, you know, like I actually don't use my phone that often. It's always on silent or vibrate. So I'm not constantly thinking of checking it. I walk a lot in nature. So anytime I'm near parks, I go for walks. The best ways for me to disconnect, though, is like if I'm with friends or I'm at a party or I'm at something where we always want to document everything. Now this age is about documenting your happiness, you know? And so what I've been trying to do is just resist the urge to record everything and just be in the moment. I think it's so difficult for people, because you want to remember the happy times. You want to have these memories for later. But there's also the other part, if people are honest, they just want to show it off. They want to show that they're having a great time.
Yeah.
They want to post it and all of those things. And I get the memories aspect. I get it sometimes. But I think really, if you're going to really be in the moment, enjoy your time, you have to put the phone away.
Yeah. You know?
And so that's something I'm working on, because I used to record a lot, and I found that I wasn't even sure if I had a good time. Mm. You know, it looked like it. I think it's small things like that. And they're all very simple and very free things that you can do. It's one of the other things that I think is really important that I'm trying to implement is actually just getting a regular alarm clock and not having my phone charging next to my bed.
Never thought about that.
Waking up and checking it. Yeah, I think it's one of the most important things. Like, I want to just charge my phone in the living room, and then in my bedroom is just a regular alarm. And there's so many new ones that come out where you could just change the tunes you wake up to, whatever. I would just want to wake up to those sounds and then not have my phone be the first thing I check in the morning. It's like you really have to train yourself to disconnect and to not need it. You know, it should not be the first thing that you reach for and all that you check. It just means you're so dependent on it. And, you know, everything has to, it also goes to this, what you mentioned, the instant gratification. It's just the same thing. You need this instant access. You need people to instant contact, people to respond to you right away. We've become so impatient and probably a little selfish with, you know, the way technology has advanced, and, you know, it can come out in the simplest moments. You know, if your Wi-Fi is buffering, you're pissed because it's taking too long.
Yes, it's made us impatient.
Yeah, it really has. And I think it's not until people realize those things, that they start to make mm-hmm. some of these changes, or they've seen, you know, they've been in a moment where they didn't have to be on their phone so much and mm-hmm. they kind of enjoyed it, that they start mm-hmm. making those changes. I think it would be hard to convince somebody who grew up with it.
Yeah.
And they don't know, you know, anything else. I'm hoping that it will slowly change.
I think so. And it also seems as if, I'm not calling anything, but this period with COVID-19 and the pandemic, it allowed our generation, specifically millennials, to slow down. It forced us to slow down. And it seems as if every generation encounters something that counteracts the biggest distractions in their lives. So I'm wondering what that will be for Gen Z. I hope it's nothing like, you know, nothing as life-changing or life-ending as COVID-19, but COVID-19, it forced the world to slow down. Mm-hmm. It forced us to stay inside and spend time with family. It forced us to live life in a different way. And I don't think that we'll ever be the same again. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I mean, even after the world reopens, I think that there are certain things that we took for granted before that we will never take for granted again. Our relationships, the things that matter the most to us, what our time really means for us, what working from home versus working in an office round the clock, what healthy habits at work look like. It's been a life-changing experience. So I wonder if that's something that Gen Z will go through, that will kind of break up their relationship with technology and force them to live in the moment. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. So that's just something that immediately came to mind. But we are almost out of time. But I think that we finished everything on our agenda. I am so grateful that you took the time out to come and speak to me. We've never met before. This is our first time seeing each other, interacting with each other. And I am just so blessed and encouraged by your story, and that you guys, I encourage you to go and look at Althea.com. Althea Therapy. Give me the website again. .com. Yeah. It is. And I'm going to put a screenshot so that they could see, a screen recording so that they could see. But it is so professional, so well laid out, so inspirational. So I'm hoping people from other regions could use this as a pattern after it, so that their communities could also have access to mental health and mental wellness professionals. But we covered so much today, and I hope that someone out there watching is encouraged, could utilize some of the information given and apply it to their lives. Personally, I really hope that we could do this again sometime in the future. I'm not sure when I will be doing this series again, but you are definitely my go-to person. You're so articulate, you're so knowledgeable, and you're such a unique person to talk to. I'm so blessed that you were able to share this moment with us. So those are my closing thoughts, guys. I will put Micheline's information down below, so if you want to reach out to her, if you want her to come and speak. I don't know if you do speaking engagements.
I would love to.
See, guys, she's open to it. So I'll leave her information, not just to her website, but also that you could contact her and reach out to her. And, you know, let's start something beautiful when it comes to mental health. Thanks again, Micheline.
Thank you. It was so lovely to meet you, and I'm really glad we had the chance to talk.
Yes.